If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, I'm Seth Meyers, and welcome to another episode of Late Night Lit, our podcast series that dives deep into the world of literature and authors. I'm going to turn things over to our own Sarah Jenks Daly, who interviews two great authors on today's episode. Take it away, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, supervising producer at Late Night with Seth Meyers. Welcome to Late Night Lit. This month, we're featuring conversations with two writers who have written about very personal subjects, each with a very different approach. First up, we have Hua Xu, author of Stay True, a memoir. Then we're joined by Alyssa Bassist, author of Hysterical, a memoir. Plus, Chelsea Clinton shares with us what book she recommends for your next read. Our first conversation this month is with author Hua Xu. In his memoir, Stay True, Xu writes about his life as a young Taiwanese American, navigating his way through his early college years, when it's interrupted by the tragic death of one of his friends. He talks to us about both the specificity and detail with which he writes, and his perspective on grief both then and now. Here's my conversation with Hua Xu. One of the more moving and poignant books I've had the pleasure of reading over the summer was a memoir written by our first guest today. Hua Xu, thanks for joining us and welcome to Late Night Lit.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Your memoir is wonderful and moving and different from most that I've read because it recounts not your entire life, but rather a certain time in your life, predominantly when you were in college at Berkeley and one of your close friends, Ken, was killed in a carjacking. Mm-hmm. You reflect in the book about having thought about writing about all of this for years. I was wondering if you could talk about the process, which I'd imagine was both emotional and circuitous, but if you could kind of talk about what it was like for you to bring the story to pages.
Yeah, absolutely. I think circuitous is probably the right term. We all found out on a Monday in July of 1998. We were in our 20s. I had just turned 21. And I immediately just went down the street and bought a journal and started writing. Like, I'd always liked writing. I'd always liked exploring kind of facets of myself and my beliefs through writing. But it just took on a different kind of urgency. Like, all of a sudden, you sort of take for granted that the people that you come up with inside jokes with or share memories with will always be there to recount these memories over time. And I just felt this desperate need to never forget anything. So I really started writing sentences that would end up in this book 24 years later, literally just the next day. And they would take the form of letters, lists, just little scraps of memories. And over time, you know, I never really anticipated that I would become a writer or that this would become a book. It was just a project, a thing I would return to, you know, just whenever I felt like I needed to get something down. And over years, it sort of took shape as something greater than just, you know, a series of journal entries or a document that would move from laptop to laptop.
Well, I was going to ask, because it is so incredibly specific, I was struck by the detail in the events that you recount and the days and what you ate for dinner and where you were and what you drank, like what alcohol was on the table. And so I was just fascinated because I know you said you kept journals, but it was so specific. Was all of that stuff that you recounted to yourself at the time, or did some of those things come rushing back as you were writing?
I was pretty obsessive about writing in that moment. You know, like in those first few days, my friends and I, like, we were all inseparable. Like, we were just constantly hanging out. But then at the end of the night, I would just retreat to my journal and I would just write down everything that just happened. And, you know, in retrospect, it's something that I needed to do just out of a sense of, I guess, like, therapy. Mm-hmm. But it was also a way of maybe avoiding the present or just not really facing up to what was going on. Just kind of cataloging in minute detail, you know, what we ate for dinner, how much it cost, what we talked about. It was a way of perhaps not facing up to, I don't know, like larger questions of what this actually meant or just the scale of tragedy maybe. I will say that I've always been someone who has a absurd recall of random details of day-to-day life. And so when a lot of friends read it for the first time, you know, they felt like part of the story and whatnot, but they were also like, I can't believe you remember like what we drank on that night. And I'm like, yeah, it's sort of a gift and a curse of being me that I will always remember what we drank that night.
It is incredibly specific. And I agree with your friends. It's so added to the story. You really did feel like it was so easy to picture those moments and feel like you were a part of them and what you were feeling. And I'd love to also ask about the structure because it moves so smoothly. It does really feel like you're a part of this group of friends moving along through these years. And I'm so interested to learn how you pieced that together.
You know, I tend to be, like, I work as a journalist, I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker, and when I'm working on pieces for the magazine, or just traditionally when I've written for newspapers, I'm pretty obsessive about structure. Like, I have everything mapped out in my head before I sit down to write things. And with this, it really had to, I mean, I've heard people say this, but it never happened to me, but it really just came to me. Like, it really just emerged as I was writing. Initially, I thought, just based on the weight that these events held in my life, that I was like, oh, this is going to be like a 400 to 500 page book. You know, this is sort of this epic thing that we've gone through and that sort of I'm trying to think through. But in the end, I mean, I thought of it a bit like, you know, I'm a very 90s person and we used to make a lot of mixtapes. And I thought about it like there are different length tapes, right? There's the 60-minute tape, the 90-minute tape, the 110-minute tape.
Right.
And this fits like a 90-minute tape. Like, this isn't the longest, most epic, most over-the-top story. It just sort of moves through these 3 years of our lives, which cast a huge shadow on the years to come. But, you know, if I think about it, it's 3 years, I'm 45. It should feel like kind of concise. And so I think that's sort of how I approached it, just that it had to be the right container. It had to, like, feel the right weight in your hand in relation to, like, you know, the span of one's life.
I think that's a good segue to move into talking about music because it was pretty evident how important that's been in your life. And it seemed to define a lot of your friendships during that time and just conversations that you had about music and bands.
Yeah.
And also how you bonded with your dad, which you talk about in the book a little bit. Can you talk about the role that music played or continues to play in your life?
You know, I think as a teenager, I was 13 when Nirvana's Nevermind came out, and I felt like I had this singular grasp of what they were trying to do and sort of their intervention. Like, that was this huge moment for people who were probably between the ages of, I want to say, like, 12 and 16. I think if you were 17 or 18, maybe, when Nirvana came out, like, you weren't that impressed because, you know, you'd been into, like, other stuff. But, you know, this was the first time I saw something popular that also seemed a little bit edgy or a little bit confrontational. And most importantly, like, it was the first time I saw something popular that was also felt like it was at odds with its own popularity. Like, they felt very ambivalent about being famous. And I think that growing up in the 80s and 90s, when celebrity culture was so big, that really stood out to me as a teenager. And so I think all teenagers are just looking for ways to distinguish themselves from their peers, as well as ways to fit in with their peers. And for me, it was music. I was initially not into music because my father was like very into buying records when I was younger. And so when I was a kid and he would drag me to the record store, I just thought, this is something only adults are into. Like, I'm going to opt out of this. But once I got to middle school, I realized that it was actually pretty great having a father and a mother who were so into music, who would, you know, take me to buy singles and CDs and whatnot. And I think for them, you know, they're immigrants from Taiwan. I always think that the sounds of Bob Dylan, Neil Young, you know, Janis Joplin, Aretha Franklin, it taught them something about this new country and these new possibilities that they were entering into. And it taught me something similar too. It was probably just a bit more ephemeral.
You talked a little bit about, in that answer, about popular music. And I thought that was something that was so funny to me about your friendship with Ken, because at the beginning of you meeting him, you write in the book that he wasn't a person that you would have been immediately attracted to because you at that time were so against liking things that everybody else liked.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it actually makes me like an incredibly generic person, even though at the time I thought I was radically different. But yeah, I think for a lot of people, when you go to college, it's the first time you're going to encounter just hundreds, if not thousands of people, right, that are your age, that are kind of roughly into the same things you're into. And you can kind of instantly, you know, you hope that you find a new team, right, or a new tribe. And that's certainly one thing that drew me to Berkeley, like in the 1990s. I was like, there's so many record stores here. There's so many bookstores. Like, there have to be people just like me. And so when I entered the dorms as a first-year student, I was really attracted to people who dressed exactly the way I did or who had the same posters I did. I just didn't meet any of those people. And instead, I met people like my friend Ken. And I judged him mercilessly based on his CD collection. I think anyone who seemed too mainstream to me was this isn't why I came to Berkeley, right? I didn't come to Berkeley to make the same kinds of friends I'd always had, folks who just, you know, listened to the radio or watched MTV. And so, you know, I was incredibly elitist and, you know, kind of almost generically pretentious about the people in my life. But, you know, to his credit, he was very open-minded and very patient. And once I saw beneath the surface, which was very easy to do very quickly, once we actually started hanging out, it kind of changed my perspective on a lot of things.
He seemed to see beneath the surface of you, too, like that wasn't exactly who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he had this theory that everything we did in life was just to kind of communicate desire to people or like, you know, to impress people. And I would always say, no, I'm not really trying to impress anyone. Like, this is just who I am. Like, I'm different from you. Like, I don't care what people think of me. He's like, no, you care what people who are just like you think about you. And so, you know, it was in those moments when I realized that there are different ways to be cool. Like, it's not about what you're wearing or what you're listening to, what you're watching. It can also just be a comfort in your own skin, you know, like a willingness to be a fool in front of a friend. Like, there are just other ways that you can be kind of an authentic, cool person.
Yeah. And I think as you age, which I really loved so much in the book, is you write about finding kind of new ways to consider friendship and as maybe more temporary than you imagined a friendship might be, and that the weight of friendships and relationships in college or of that college age is so much heavier and seems to mean so much more when you're in it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I have a 7-year-old kid, and I'm often thinking like, there's no way you don't appreciate like what you have as a 6 or 7-year-old, and it's so ridiculous, right? I mean, I think it's the obligation of the young not to think too much about the present, and I think even when you're 18, 19, 20, you know, it's impossible to think too deeply about the bonds around you. Like, you think a lot about your friends, but you don't think about friendship and what that means and sort of the bonds and obligations and duties of being a friend. Like, you think more about the immediacy, the next adventure, like the next thing you're going to do to get, like, what are you going to do this weekend? And it's something that I didn't fully appreciate till I was much older, because I never would have had a reason to hold on to these memories of our friendship. I never would have had a reason to write down everything we were eating and drinking until that sort of physical manifestation of friendship was over. And so it's something that I've thought about a lot in relation to a lot of the people who are in the book with whom I'm still friends. But also, you know, I teach at a college now, and I'm around young people all the time who don't necessarily remind me of myself, but who are trying to figure out the world in their own ways. And so I'm always studying the way that they treat one another. And it's, I don't know, it can be very uplifting too.
Yeah, I'd imagine. Well, I was going to ask, you're not only a journalist, but also a professor. What is your favorite thing about teaching? Is it that you get to see these younger students sort of discover the world and who they are?
Yeah, I think a secret that we don't often reveal to our students, although I'm telling you this now in a public forum, is that the great thing about being a teacher of any sort is that you actually get to learn a lot, you know, and I have access to, you know, I've had access to like 15 or 16 different cohorts of young people over the years. And I learned so much about their perspectives, what they expect out of the world, what they want out of the world. And it sort of keeps me going. Like, I'm responsible for teaching them, you know, how to write without the passive voice, or, you know, like what law was passed this year that resulted in sort of these cultural shifts. But more importantly, like, I want to teach them a relationship to the world. I want to teach them a sense of kind of why these questions I'm asking them might matter beyond this classroom. Like, what is it you want out of the world? What is it you love? What is it you hate? Why do you love and why do you hate these things? And these aren't questions that are settled in my mind for myself. So just the opportunity to, you know, read great books with a different group of kids each year. Sometimes they love the stuff I love, sometimes they hate the stuff I love, but we have to reckon with one another, and it's a really rare gift to be able to do that. And I think I probably learn more from them than they often learn from me.
That's a really nice way of looking at it. And speaking of great books, this is one of them. I enjoyed it so much, and I hope all of our listeners get the opportunity to read it. Finally, it's our tradition here to ask our guests to recommend a book. So if you have one you'd like to share with our listeners, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah, sure. There's this novel coming out next month by the writer Ryan Lee Wong. It's his debut novel. It's called Which Side Are You On? And it's a novel about this Asian American kid. It's funny that we're just talking about college. He's this college student trying to figure out his place in the world, but the backdrop is like Black Lives Matter, like a lot of the sort of campus activism, direct action. And he basically goes home to hang out with his mom. His mom had been involved in sort of the cleanup after the 1992 LA uprisings. And it just, you know, it's like kind of funny. It's also just sort of this meditation on what it means to be a young kind of politically minded person nowadays. Yeah, it's a total delight. It's called Which Side Are You On? By Ryan Lee Wong.
That sounds great. I'll have to read that one. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, it was so wonderful to talk to you.
Sarah, this is a blast. Thanks so much.
After the break, we're joined by author Alyssa Bassist.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Our second conversation is with Alyssa Bassist, an essayist, editor, and the author of Hysterical, a memoir. It is fascinating, deeply personal, and also happens to be a very funny read. It explores Alyssa's own medical history and also examines the way women's voices are silenced and drowned out in an antiquated and patriarchal system. Here's my conversation with Alyssa Bassist. Alyssa Bassist, thanks for being here and welcome to Late Night Lit.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So your memoir is one that details your experience after the 2016 election and, of course, delves into much more from there. But for those who haven't read it yet, can you give a little background about what exactly happened to you and where the book starts?
Yes. So it starts the day of the 2016 election. I started a mood stabilizer because, obviously, that was the only way I was going to survive the next 4 years. Cut to 3 months later, I could not see my television screen, which for me was an emergency. My vision was blurry. I went to go get it checked out. It turned out my prescription was fine. Then it kept changing. Then this lack of vision turned into what I called a wire hanger in the brain headache that went on every day for 6 months. Then I ended up getting a slew of other symptoms over the next 2 years, saw over 20 medical professionals and amateurs to figure out what was going on with me. And I won't spoil what it was.
I don't want to spoil it either, but you write about female pain, I think, in many various ways. And it was, at least for me, difficult to fathom not only living through this, like wire hanger in the brain, in addition to other things, but also process it in a way that could have led to a book. So I'd love if you could talk about how writing maybe helped you understand what you were experiencing and perhaps maybe helped you see it from a different perspective of not just you personally, but women historically.
So when I was sick, I was not thinking of writing about it. I was in the middle of writing a book and I quit because I realized I needed to survive and not worry about getting published. And I couldn't listen to like any sound, like any sort of input from the world was impossible for me. That's how much pain I was in. I remember the only thing I could do was listen to the Larry Sanders Show at whisper volume while lying in the fetal position in the dark at the foot of my bed. And I was like, this is my life now. So I abandoned my book completely, because survival took front seat. And then afterwards, because I'm a writer and because I had already been working on this book for like, I think a decade at that point, and I had been working on a lot of other themes that ended up to coincide with women's pain and chronic illness and mysterious illness and how we interact in a doctor's office and how that's not so different from interactions we see on television shows, from interactions in intimate relationships, interactions at work. I was seeing so many connections, and I was noticing that the sexism I had experienced in the workplace, in my relationships, living in the world, was the same sexism I was experiencing with medical professionals. The term that came out recently is medical gaslighting. And I was like, that's me, that's this. And the more I looked into why I was getting the treatment I was getting, or lack thereof, and why I kept getting the diagnosis that nothing was wrong with me, even though I was literally and figuratively dying, I found out that since the beginning of time, the male body has been the human body, which is to say male suffering is suffering and every other kind of suffering isn't. And our entire world is based on the white male body. So women are prescribed inaccurate dosages, often are over-medicated, under-treated, under-diagnosed, and our pain is not taken seriously. And we also don't take our own pain seriously. We underrate our own pain because we don't want to be seen as annoying or frustrating or difficult. So all these forces are conspiring for us to repress that pain until many of us die. We have one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, and a lot of it's due to this disbelief that women are in pain.
Well, I think it's also important to point out that you managed to address so much of this with humor, which is at the core of so much that you write. But in this particular instance, how did humor maybe help you better convey your own experience to potential readers or help you sort of process as you were writing?
I would not have been able to get through this book if I weren't able to joke about the darkest things that had happened to me and to find ways to amuse myself. And so much in life is so absurd that the only way to process it and to talk about it is to match that absurdity and to make fun of it and the structures around us. And I also am a humor writing teacher, and I know that people will listen to a joke over a sob story. And if you want people to believe you and hear you, you have to make them laugh at the same time. That's been true in my life. And I moved to New York to get my master's of fine arts in creative nonfiction. And I was such a humorless asshole in this program, and it was like the place where laughter came to die. So I was writing about the darkest of topics, depression, suicide, rape culture. So I decided to take improv classes just to save me from my own mind. And I learned so much about writing, and I could, and I did apply it to my life and everything that I'd written in the future forevermore. And I was like, this is how I get through writing about such dark topics. Rule of three, yes and.
The book also combines personal experience with a great deal of research ranging from medical, psychological, studies on gender. How did you find your way through the myriad of texts and information that I'm assuming you encountered while writing?
So I worked on the book for 11 years only, thank you. And during that time, I read the news every day, so I was a real sad person. And so I was keeping tabs on all these new studies coming out. I had so much information. All these books were coming out about what we're learning about chronic pain, autoimmune disease, mortality rates, homicide rates. But at the same time, all of this stuff is really underreported. A lot of what happens to women isn't newsworthy, isn't worth writing about or reading about. So even though I had a lot of research, it wasn't too much. I was able to gather it all and not feel completely overwhelmed because of the lack of caring about women's issues in the world. So that ended up being quite a blessing and a curse.
Did you have to take mental breaks from reading about how women's health is routinely treated? Because I think through reading the book, a lot of it maybe wasn't particularly surprising to me, but simultaneously was infuriating.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Yes, yeah, so I did the smartest thing in the world, which was right before I sold my book, I adopted a dog. And I am very good at panic attacks. I love to have them. But then I got this dog and I would assume the fetal position and he would bring me his toys or jump on my back or give me kisses. And so it was impossible to panic. And I couldn't actually fall apart because I would just look at him and be the happiest I'd ever been in my whole life. Like, screw the mood stabilizer, just adopt dogs. Like, we don't need pharmaceuticals anymore. Animals are the answer. So that truly saved my life. Every time I would just like look dead-faced off into space after reading one statistic after another about how the world does not care if women die and in fact wishes us dead, I would just go downstairs and I see this sweet little busted up Yorkie. He has a bad eye. He's obese. He has very few teeth. He's the love of my life. So that was great. And I think I only had one mental breakdown, and it was after watching Promising Young Woman. And I needed to break down because I was like, I can't turn off all of my feelings. Like, I don't want to be numb to everything I'm reading. Like, everything I'm reading deserves a panic attack and deserves a primal scream and a call for revolution and to be so academic and unfeeling about it. That's not what I wanted. So having that breakdown was important. And breaking down, that's important. I mean, a part of getting sick was repressing all of that feeling and all of those screams because I was afraid of that big of a feeling. And I was afraid of how other people would feel about me feeling so much and expressing so much about it.
You mentioned being a humor writer and teaching, and I know that you're also an editor. I was curious to know if writing this book made you approach teaching any differently.
I would say teaching made me approach writing the book differently. I see so many of my students self-reject and ask for permission to write what they want to write, and they don't need to do either. And I felt that when I'm my teacher self, I'm my best self, and I try to bring my teacher self to my writing self, who is my worst self. And I would just try to remind myself that it's okay if I'm embarrassing myself. It's okay. Like, all of the reasons I was giving myself to stop writing were just reasons to let float in the wind and like go by so that I could get my work done. Because it's all about getting the work done and getting out of your own way.
I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us today. And I'm so glad this book is out in the world. So congratulations on finishing after only 11 years.
Thank you.
Finally, we like to ask our guests for a book recommendation. Do you have one that you'd be willing to share with our listeners?
Yes, I'm reading a great book called How to Read Now by Elaine Castillo. It is about how our reading habits and the publishing industry is completely out of whack and due for a revolution. And it is whip smart and will change the way you see the entire world. And it's all about how we read is how we do everything. And we must change how we read and how we do everything.
Thank you for sharing. That sounds like a great read. Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Each month, we ask late night guests to share with us what they've been reading. This month, author and philanthropist Chelsea Clinton tells us what book she recommends for your next read.
Hi, this is Chelsea Clinton, most recently the author of Welcome to the Big Kids Club, my book that helpfully, I hope, gives older kids answers to questions they probably have about a new younger sibling, such as why don't they have teeth and why do they poop so much? On a slightly more serious note, a book I'd really just love to recommend, like full-throated, whole heart, is Maya Rose Craig's book, Bird Girl. Maya Rose Craig is a young ornithologist and bird aficionado from the United Kingdom. She's the youngest person, at least as we know, to have seen more than half of the world's bird species. She's seen more than 5,000 different types of birds. And she talks not only about her love of birding and how it has helped her family navigate through some really challenging times, also how her love of birding has helped her navigate through the online and sometimes in real life trolls who don't think that a young woman should be the face of birding or to be such an amazing and amazingly talented birder, or who especially don't think that a young woman of color should do that. And so I just am so in awe of Maya Rose Craig, and her book also is really well written. So it's a great read, and it's a good read, and I hope you'll check it out.
This has been Late Night Lit. My thanks to Seth Meyers, Mike Shoemaker, Washu, Alyssa Bassist, Matt Ryman, Jay Johnson, Ross Leupold, and Rafael Ojuelos. Our theme music was written and performed by the 8G Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly. Thank you for listening and happy reading.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.